Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. We're Susan Faulkner makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce her briefly. She's a Sydney writer. Her previous biographies include The Image, E.L. Grant Watson and Australia, Mrs. Mort's Madness, The True Story of a Sydney Scandal, which is what you addressed us on last time, and Eugenia, A Man, which was first published in 1988 and an updated edition in 2014, Joan in India, and Lizard Island, The Journey of Mary Watson. Dr. Faulkner's lived in Paris, Umbria and New York and has studied at the University of New South Wales and Columbia University, and in 2005 she was awarded a doctorate of Creative Arts at the University of Technology, Sydney. But Susan Faulkner's here today to talk on the topic, Remembering Randolph Soh, Australian Literary Legend, on the occasion of the launch of her book Mick, A Life of Randolph Soh, which has just come out. So, Susan Faulkner, you're very welcome, talking about Remembering Randolph Soh. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
It's very nice of you to come out on this wet evening, and we're only, as Anne described it, an intimate group, so I hope we'll have a good discussion at the end, which is always more fun with a smaller group. To start with, I was flattered but a little bit alarmed to read on the Sydney Institute email for this talk that I was going to unlock the meaning of Randolph Soh's rich and introspective works, even though these words do appear in a slightly different context on the blurb of my biography. Some hundreds of critical articles have been published about Randolph Soh by worthy academics, and as well as several book-length studies. And to me, each reading of his works still brings new interpretations. During my research, I became aware that Soh didn't really like people speaking for him, although he was generally willing to answer questions if they were asked in good faith. What I've tried to do, in fact, in Mick, A Life of Randolph Soh, is to place his books and poetry in the context of his life, and thus let the reader develop his or her own understanding. His works were extremely poetic and complex, but they were also coded and autobiographical. So at the end, I'll try to answer any questions you might have about his books. But another thing I learnt that was important about Randolph, or Mick Soh, was that he had a very dry sense of humour. I'm sure with an audience as well-read and well-informed as this, I don't have to remind you much about Mick's stellar literary career. How in 1959, at the age of 23, he made his mark as the second ever winner of the Miles Franklin Award for his third novel, To the Islands. That was the year after Patrick White won the first one for Voss. How, over the next three decades, he went on to write Tourmaline, a groundbreaking work, along with his much-loved semi-autobiographical novel, The Merry-Go-Round and the Sea. Then came his children's story, Midnight, then Visitants, The Girl Green as Elderflower, and The Suburbs of Hell. All these books helped to give Australians a new way of looking at their world. Despite all this, unlike Patrick White, who made his beliefs pretty clear in his public life, after some 4 years of research, I found I still didn't know very much about Soh's political beliefs. I don't know how he voted in any Australian election, or after he became a British citizen in early 1972, whether he voted in any election in the United Kingdom. So tonight, I thought it might be more fun to have a look at the hints of Randolph Stowe's life, that Randolph Stowe's life give us about his politics. First of all, his family background on both sides would suggest a certain conservative leaning. His father's family, the Stowes, were devoted to law and the Lord, with a number of his antecedents becoming judges, lawyers and politicians. Mick's great-grandfather, Thomas Quinton Stowe, started the first Congregational Church in South Australia in 1837. His great-grandfather, Randolph Isham Stowe, was one of the first three Queen's Councils in Adelaide and later a Supreme Court judge. He also entered politics, serving as State Attorney General in three ministries. When he died of atrophy of the liver at the age of 49, in September 1878, he was given a state funeral with a cortege a mile long, and on the following Sunday, eulogies honouring his uprightness were delivered in St. Peter's Cathedral and eight other churches. Perhaps finding the Stowe legacy weighing a little heavily in Adelaide, the next two generations of Stowe's antecedents, his grandfather Francis and his father Cedric, who also trained as lawyers, retreated to Western Australia, one to Perth and the next to Geraldton. Mick's mother Mary Stowe, née Sewell, was also of a conservative bent. The daughter of Geraldton's mayor, she was working as a secretary in Cedric's law firm when they were married. Her own father, George Ernest Sewell, was a descendant of one of the earliest pastoral pioneers in the district. He'd taken up land there in the 1850s. In old age, describing her childhood membership of a chums union, a band of little girls devoted to Victorian moral virtues, Mary Stowe remarked that this was the only union she'd ever belonged to. Some of Mary's maternal relatives, however, were a little more unpredictable. Mick's grandmother Alice and his adored great-aunt Sutherland MacDonald, who lived nearby in Geraldton, were descended from Gaelic-speaking stock and introduced him to the romantic poems and ballads of their Scottish antecedents. Proudly nationalistic, perhaps it was Southey who caused the young Mick Stowe to show signs of breaking away while quite young. In The Merry-Go-Round and the Sea, Stowe describes an early trip to Perth, round about 1946, in which his 10-year-old alter ego Rob visits London Court, an arcade built to resemble a cobbled London street. And I'll read you this. Perth was ancient, an ancient civilization. Soot-darkened buildings proved it, and the existence of a museum. And it was a very special city, cut off from other cities by sea and desert, so that there was not another city for 2,000 miles. Among all Australian cities, it had proved itself the most special by a romantic act called the Succession, which other cities had stuffily ignored. Cinderella State, he thought, feeling indignant. That was the reason for the secession. Because they had ignored his poor Cinderella State, all 1 million square miles of it. Maybe after this war there'd be another war. Western Australia against the world. Black swan flying. We shouldn't have gone to Parliament House, his mother had remarked. It seems to have made you political. I'm a rebel, he'd replied. I've got rebel blood. Walking along the terrace, he dreamed of Eureka, the torn banner of the Republic of Victoria. But not a republic, not in Western Australia. That would hurt the feelings of Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret Rose. When will Western Australia be free, he wondered. I don't know, said his mother. Perhaps when Bonnie Prince Charlie comes over. He grew disgusted at her flippancy. In later years, Mick would come to criticise his mother Mary Stowe's political conservatism, her anti-Catholicism and her class consciousness. What a friend of his called that small town snootiness that you associate with the wives of doctors and lawyers. The two often squabbled or contradicted each other or scored points off each other. But this same friend recalled, he also remembered her kindness. Mick's father Cedric was again something of a wild card, always quiet, In later years, he sank into depression and became almost totally silent, even within his family. As a solicitor, he acted for the town's Italian fruit growers and lobster fishermen. Once, during the Depression, he was paid his fee in bananas. By the time Mick was in primary school, he'd become aware of his father's sense of social justice. A school friend of Mick's told me that the teachers at Geraldton Primary School sat his sister Helen next to one of the Aboriginal, or Yamachi pupils, then commonly called in the town black niggers, because the school knew that his family would not come hurrying down to the school to complain. Later, Mick learned from the writer Nini Gere, whose husband Frank worked for the local Native Welfare Association, that his father had spoken up against the town council when they wanted to clear the Yamachi homes off the common land at Mount Misery on the town's outskirts, and his father had prevailed. By the time Stowe was sent to Guildford Grammar School in Perth at age 14, his anti-authoritarian stance was such that he had no qualms about challenging the headmaster, Mr. Thwaites, about the school's emphasis on sports, which he loathed, at the expense of art, dance and music. One of his ways of protesting was to write for the school magazine The Swan, which once led to an entire print run being recalled and the relevant pages torn out. There's an extract from that article in the book. Someone managed to keep a copy. During sports, I'm told, he was usually found hiding out in the change room, reading and smoking cigarettes. At this stage, he was fond of Ogden Nash, the Bronte sisters, and perhaps a touch of Gilbert and Sullivan, as in this playful verse he published, in which he rails against the then much-studied average man. To every little incident, they noted his reactions and worked out his mentality in decimals and fractions. His broadcast talk in London was relayed to the Dominions, and every worthwhile paper had a space for his opinions. You can see he had an instinct for rhythm and rhyme, even at the age of about 14 or 15. At the University of Western Australia, after his school days in the Guildford Cadets, which he equally disliked, Mick had not taken kindly to the idea of 6 months mandatory national service, or NASHOs, which, as we know, was introduced in the early days of the Korean War. When he and some other 18-year-olds attended their medical examination in Perth in November 1953, one of his fellow students told me, Mick reported to the interviewers that he suffered from shortness of breath, sleepwalking, eye trouble, hearing problems, frequent stomach and bowel trouble, travel sickness, and that he needed glasses for reading. And he argued for so long that they all went back to college without him. Nevertheless, he was accepted. The following year, Stowe, as a university student, published several strongly political poems. One was Song for a Chinese Route March, another was On the Road to Purgatory, and another was called Change in the St. George's College magazine. Markedly anti-war in theme, the first was influenced by revelations of starvation among Chinese soldiers before the Korean War armistice. And the second described Stowe's continued aversion to the idea of compulsory national service. A bitter unpublished fragment called The Conscript, taking off Rupert Brooke, was kept by one of his friends. If I should kill, think only this of me. I murdered God to save our vanity. By 1956, while still an undergraduate, Mick had completed two precocious novels, both loosely based on scandalous incidents among his pioneering forebears, which were published in England, but which he later repudiated. He got into quite a lot of trouble with various extended family members for that. His poetry was now also appearing in national and international magazines, including Punch and The Bulletin. In Mianjin that year, Clem Christensen published Montebello's, his most overtly political poem to date, which linked the dead from past shipwrecks with Britain's nuclear tests in the nearby Montebello Islands that year. Jack Honnable, an old school friend, satirised Stowe in the College Magazine, describing a breakfast table discussion in which their resident young novelist gave his opinion of the Suez Crisis. "I hope the English get thrown out of Egypt, Cyprus, Scotland and everywhere else." When Mick left university, he spent some years working on an Anglican mission at Forest River in the Kimberley, which gave him material, of course, for his novel To the Islands. He'd already published several poems expressing his sense of injustice done to Aborigines, notably Aboriginal Dream Song in the Bulletin under Douglas Stewart in 1956. In this, the arrival of European ships begins a process of turning the tribal people into ghosts. Two more, Blackjack's Doppelganger and Jabalmara Dancing, a tribute to a friend who taught him to dance at Forest River, he sent to Vincent Buckley at Prospect magazine. Stowe spent most of the next 2 years tutoring at the University of Adelaide and studying anthropology at the University of Sydney, after which, with the help of Paul Hasluck, in 1959 he went up to Papua New Guinea to work as a cadet patrol officer. After being repatriated to Australia after a mental and physical breakdown, he went to England to recuperate. For the next few years, he seesawed between Australia and England, and then accepted a Harkness Travelling Fellowship to the United States. Here he wrote of how oppressed he felt by the country's marked racial divide while driving through Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. One night in Texas in November 1964, he wrote to a friend, "He'd met the most unpleasant segregationist I've yet come across." And this is a quote from the letter. "He had a cafe outside Del Rio, and he was entertaining his customers by telling them how he'd bought a shotgun the day the Bill of Rights became law, because Uncle Sam has taught me how to kill, and I don't mind doing it. He also said Kennedy wasn't a Catholic because he was a goddamn communist, and the goddamn communists don't believe in God. I must have looked like a goddamn liberal, because when I left, this murdering son of a bitch followed me out to the car and we had a long staring match." Tensions were high in the US at that time as Americans debated the Civil Rights Act. In a hotel lounge in the Texas town of Marfa, Mick watched the election where Lyndon Johnson, the incumbent Democrat, defeated the Republican Barry Goldwater, carrying 44 out of 50 states. After this, Mick settled in the rather more laid-back atmosphere of Aztec, New Mexico, where he wrote The Merry-Go-Round and the Sea. By the following summer, he was studying Indonesian at Yale, and the call-up for the Vietnam War was a pervasive topic, as each month some of his American student friends were obliged to report to their draft boards. American foreign policy had begun to grate on him, he wrote home. He felt that where the young were concerned, America was practically a totalitarian society. "Everyone in Washington is so goddamn virtuous and altruistic," he wrote. "One would never think that the same people had trained their own version of the Viet Cong in Guatemala and tried to land it in Cuba, or fomented a rebellion by a sort of Islamic Ku Klux Klan in Indonesia." After America, Stowe moved to England again, where he settled down in a farm cottage in Suffolk. In 1972, for a Melbourne Age article called "The Divided Affections of a Restless Novelist," Stowe explained to a journalist that he was an accidental expatriate and that chance had directed his progress to date rather than any conscious rejection of Australia. "He was very attached to his homeland," he said, "but some aspects of it made him raging mad." Quote, "The awful smug indifference and mediocrity of so many of the people in politics, the stupidity of some of our foreign policies. Nevertheless, he still thought he might end up living in Australia." In June 1973, at the urging of his mother, who wanted him to come home, Stowe applied for a grant from the Australian Council of the Arts. Mick had closely followed the previous December's Australian elections, which had brought Gough Whitlam's new Labour government to power. "Australians in London had been wearing 'It's Time' buttons," he reported to Mary Stowe. William McMahon, he thought, sounded very dim, and the English journalists obviously favoured Whitlam. That January, he'd been invited for the first time to Australia House in London for the Australia Day celebrations and had attended out of curiosity. He was even more cheered by Nixon's announcement that month of the end of America's involvement in the Vietnam War. In May, he wrote, he'd been summoned to meet Gough Whitlam himself at a cocktail party at the High Commissioner's house. The Whitlams hadn't appeared for very long, he wrote to his mother, but long enough for everyone to see that they were very big. Although they appeared quite stunted beside their sons. His friend Russell Braddon had been particularly taken with Margaret Whitlam. Russ thinks she's lovely, which is something from a Neanderthal Tory like him, he wrote. In that first year, writers swamped the literature board with 1,100 applications. The new board members were Banning Clark, Jeff Dutton, Dick Hall, A.D. Hope, Nancy Keesing, David Malouf, Betty Riddell, Richard Walsh, and Judah Watton, with Jeffrey Blaney as chairman and Michael Costigan as executive director. Mick had applied for one of the senior awards, a three-year fellowship. Soon after, the Adelaide Festival Committee had invited him to come to Adelaide for the premiere of Miss Donnithorne's Maggot, a musical theatre piece he'd written with the English composer Peter Maxwell Davies. I'm sorry you're so down on the Whitlams, Mick wrote to Mary Stowe in July, telling her of his planned arrival the following month. And you're quite wrong to say they're making Australia a laughingstock, but it's not your fault if you have to depend for information on the half-witted Australian press. The fact is they're enormously popular here. Nick Whitlam, one of the gigantic sons, told me they were quite mystified by their own fatal fascination. No doubt he's making mistakes and will make more, but he's done a marvellous job for Australia's image. Later that month, Stowe heard from Jeffrey Blaney that the Literature Board had unanimously recommended him for a three-year grant of $9,000 per annum, without conditions, not even that he spent it in Australia. The first instalment of $500 was due in early August. Stowe responded that now he hoped to return to Australia for a year to write a book about the wreck of the Batavia in the Abrolhos Islands in 1629, and then he'd return to England to work on an historical book about exploration in the Indian Ocean that necessitated his being within reach of the museums and the libraries of Europe. The August payment would certainly help him through a leanish period before his next royalties were due, he wrote. Mick was obviously chuffed. I wonder what you'll think of Whitlam now, he wrote to his mother the same day. A day later, he sent his friend Jeanne Jeffers a cheerfully rude chanson anti-nucléaire, a satirical pastiche of La Marseillaise entitled La Mourouroise, dedicated to the Right Honourable Gough Whitlam, Prime Minister of Australia. He intended to send it to both Whitlam and to Norman Kirk, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, he wrote, in the hope that he'll sing it at the Ambassador of France. Mick arrived in Western Australia by ship in late February 1974. Unknown to most, he was recovering from depression and a severe addiction to the drug Mandrax, medically prescribed to him for his insomnia. Partly as a result, after his early successes, he was in the grip of a severe writing block that had lasted for some years. He was optimistic that the Australian trip might help him to recover from it. After the Adelaide Festival, Stowe travelled to Melbourne, Perth and Geraldton. Much of the rest of his time he spent in retreat in his cousin John Jefferson Bray's house in Adelaide. However, he'd remained unable to work and after some months decided to return to England. In Sydney before his departure, friends and acquaintances noticed his reckless behaviour and heavy drinking. From the SS Britannus in Sydney Harbour on 19th of September, the day he sailed, he addressed a letter to Gough Whitlam, mailing a copy also to Michael Costigan. Dear Prime Minister, I'm most grateful to you and the Arts Council of Australia for making it possible for me to revisit this country. However, the removal of Professor Jeffrey Blaney from the Literature Board and the circumstances of his removal make me feel that it's impossible for me in good conscience to accept further bounty from the council. I should like it therefore to be understood that my fellowship terminates on this date. With thanks and patriotic good wishes, yours sincerely, Randolph Stowe. In Sydney, it seemed, Stowe had come across a minor contretemps. Geoffrey Blainey had left the Literature Board at the end of his inaugural chairmanship, and the transition had been ineptly handled and had damaged relationships among the members. Whatever version of the events Mick had heard had obviously upset him. Stowe's reasons for relinquishing the grant, of course, were rather more complex than this. The generosity of the new arts funding had caused gossip and envy among less successful writers, along with press complaints about profligacy with the taxpayers' money. More important, by now, Mick had realised that his writer's block remained firmly in place, and he'd not be able to complete his projected book any time soon. Despite his need for the money, he saw little honourable alternative than to relinquish the grant, and in this he joined the playwright David Williamson sometime later as one of the only two writers, Australian writers, ever to do so. Stowe never lost his fondness for the Whitlams, however. In November 1975, at his friend Bill Grono's request, he added his name to a list of leading academics, artists and writers on a half-page advertisement in the West Australian protesting the dismissal. "That business created a great stir here and made me very angry," he wrote to his mother. "I could hardly believe my ears." In early 1981, after successfully completing two more novels, Visitants and The Girl Green as Elderflower, Stowe moved from East Bergholt to Harwich. His receipt of the Patrick White Award of $10,000 in 1979, along with his mother's canny investments, had finally allowed him to buy a tiny terrace house there, the first property he'd ever owned. And I went and had a look at that house. It was literally 10 or 12 feet across, with room for the front door, with an armchair beside it and a window, and that was all, five tiny rooms. He was now aged 45. Despite his reputation as one of the most important Australian writers of his generation, his living of necessity continued to be extremely frugal over the next two decades. In his older age, when he was a little more comfortably off, Stowe supported generously a number of causes, including the World Wildlife Foundation, various local conservation and cultural societies, and in early 1991 he allowed his name to be used to support the Aboriginal land rights movement in the Kimberley. In the late 1990s, after his mother had given him a gift of her shares in the Herald and Weekly Times, which was subsequently taken over by Rupert Murdoch, Stowe was able to afford some major reservations to his Harwich home. His sale of Murdoch's bonus issue of News Corp preferred shares, which had cost him nothing, had brought him a windfall of £64,000. "For the first time in his life," he wrote to Mary Stowe in 1998, "he had all the money he needed. Best of all, his mother's original holding of the News Corp ordinary shares remained intact. I really don't understand capitalism, but at the moment I think it's beaut," he wrote. "So thank you very much for that." This was at the age of 62. Now, I'm not entirely sure what can be deduced from this small survey, so once again I'll leave you to draw whatever conclusions you like. Thank you.
Thanks. Many thanks for that. So we come to questions and discussion. Before we do, there's some copies Janet Grundy's got of Mick, A Life of Randolph Stowe, and I'm sure our author would be happy to sign any after. And so we come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time. It's nice to know that Randolph Stowe was bowed out by Rupert Murdoch in the end, I think.
I thought you'd enjoy that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. He's done a lot of good work. But you raised initially the question about Stowe's politics and listening to you there and having read some of his stuff. He seems like a kind of a very genuine man, but he's a bit of a... He's just your basic alienated left-wing intellectual, isn't he? Not entirely happy with stuff, getting by all right, but did he ever support anything?
When you say anything, do you mean a political party? Or?
Well, any government of any kind. I mean, he was always on the edges of stuff, but did he ever think that anyone in government had ever done any good anywhere?
Apart from Gough Whitlam.
Who gave out grants.
Mick, I think, was not at all interested in politics on a day-to-day basis. I think he had a sense of justice and a sense of what was right, and he would defend that to the death. He didn't like bullies. He didn't like people who criticised outsiders, of course, such as migrants and homosexuals and people of different races and creeds. But as a political animal, I don't think he really functioned as such at all. He wanted to write. He was devoted to his writing. He never made much money from it. If he did get any money, he tended to give it away. So you could really say he was probably a political naive.
It's a question here. Yeah.
When did you start writing again? You said that, what, 74-ish he gave up, but when did he actually start back at the desk, do you know?
After this 10-year break, he started writing again in 1978-79. The major reason for the break was that in New Guinea he'd had a mental breakdown and tried to kill himself. He tried to commit suicide. And this, he thought he was going mad. And this traumatized him so much that he started a book about the Trobriand Islands where he'd been working. And this, of course, was Visitants. But when he got to the stage where his character was having the breakdown and made an attempt on his life, he again sunk into such a fragile mental state that he put it in the bread oven in his cottage and couldn't write anything for another 10 years. What he did was he got up one New Year's morning, went to his desk and wrote another book, The Girl Green as Elderflower, which was a book of salvation or redemption about a man who'd come from a distressing situation and recuperated and found peace in England. When he finished that, he took it to his publisher. And his publisher, Tom Rosenthal, was delighted with it. And Mick was so uplifted by the reaction that he went straight home and within 2 months finished Visitants and delivered that to his publisher as well. And of course, history relates, Tom Rosenthal decided to publish them in reverse order so that the book of the disintegration of his personality came first and the recuperation came after that. So that was more or less the story of the writing block.
Right, thanks.
For someone who is so obviously absorbed by Australia, both culturally and its natural phenomenon, it's unusual that he never came back. He came back once, you say, as you described. And there's a photo in the book of him working sheep. I think it's him, isn't it?
Yes.
With one of his relatives. So to what extent was he very much part of Australia in some of his ordinary likes and natural feelings? I mean, there's obviously something there for someone who just ran away from it.
I think in his mind, he was always living in Australia to a degree. Particularly in old age, he'd do things like getting his mother's CWA cookbook and cooking his grandmother's recipes and things like that. But I think there were two reasons for his leaving. The first was that after the merry-go-round in the sea, he felt he'd written Australia out of him. He didn't have any more material that was coming to the surface of his mind. I think he thought if he stayed in Europe, where he could make a bit of a living giving lectures, writing reviews for the Times Literary Supplement, he might be able to continue to write, whereas in Australia he'd be incredibly poor and wouldn't be able to. The other reason, of course, was, as we know, he was homosexual. And his mother, whom he was very close to, despite their scratchy moments, he couldn't bring himself to tell her. So if he wanted to live a life of his own, he more or less had to move away from at least Perth and Geraldton. But a lot of men of his generation did precisely that.
I just want to take up the question of his lifestyle. I'm not interested in his personal intimate relations, but I guess I don't get the impression of a person who is embedded in a kind of social circle. Like, was he a member of clubs or societies, or did he have a favourite pub? I get the impression he corresponded with people, but I don't have a sense of enduring friendships.
He was a solitary person. I don't think he could have ever lived with someone full time. He had some passionate relationships, and he had some relationships where he was in love with people. But on a more social level, he had a talent for friendship. He had five or six very close friends. They were very loyal to him. One friend he met at university, and they wrote to each other and were friends. They visited each other for 50 years. Jeanne Jeffers, who of course spoke French, which was one of his passions, she was the wife of Derry Jeffers, who was his professor at Leeds when he worked there. She was very sophisticated, spoke French, and he was probably her confidant, his mother in England, so to speak. They got on very, very well, and again, they were friends from when they met in the 60s, right up until her death. There were a number of people like that. So
that's what I was inquiring about, just didn't have that type of enduring friendships. Yeah, right.
He had a number of enduring friendships, and he was a tremendously funny, an interesting letter writer, which was fortunate for me because a number of cases of these letters ended up in the library.
In which library?
The National Library of Australia. A few in the New South Wales State Library.
Stowe and alcohol. You mentioned on his Australian visit is there any correlation between times when he was drinking alcohol and not writing, or is there no correlation at all?
Well, before he wrote his books, he tended to write them in his head, and he'd do this often for a year or a couple of years, and then he'd get them down in an intense burst of activity, almost as if they were being dictated to him. As I said, visitants, the Gold Green is Elderflower, he wrote in something like 6 weeks or 2 months, and it was the same with visitants. Merry-go-round in the sea, he wrote in 2 or 3 months over the winter while it was snowing in Aztec in New Mexico. While he was inventing the book in his head, he drank quite heavily. But when he was actually writing, he stopped drinking altogether. And this may be one reason why he didn't write so much in his older age, because it just didn't seem worthwhile giving up the pleasures of drinking. He did say once, I'm not an alcoholic, but I do get awful thirsty.
Well, tell us about, you mentioned John Bray, so that would be the man who became the Chief Justice of South Australia. So he's a cousin. I mean, he stays with him for a while. Was there any particular relationship between those two?
In fact, he was a third cousin. Bray's mother was a Stowe. What actually happened was that J.J. Bray was going to Greece and Europe for a couple of months, and he and a journalist called Peter Ward, who was assistant to Don Dunstan, yes, had adjoining houses. I can't remember the name of the square in Adelaide, but anyway, essentially they offered the house to Stowe to housemind while they were away, which I think didn't work out entirely all that well, because Stowe wasn't a great housekeeper, but he did have somewhere to stay rent-free while he was in Adelaide until Peter Ward and Bray came back from their travels.
I think Christopher Pearson lived on that same square. Yes, Jeff.
He's obviously a very interesting person, and you know, you want to write about him. But was there some particular characteristic that attracted you to him, that you know, that triggered your initiative in preparing this biography?
Well, I'd always loved his writing ever since I was quite young and read The Merry-Go-Round and the Sea and worked through the other novels. I wrote a previous book called The Imago about a very obscure writer called Elliot Lovegood Grant Watson, who covered the same physical territory, except he travelled with the anthropologist Radcliffe Brown and Daisy Bates in Western Australia in 1910, and he was in Geraldton, Carnarvon, Sandstone, all that gold mining country. He had an interest in Aborigines and in anthropology. And it seems such a coincidence that these two writers, 30 years apart, were publishing novels on the same subject and with some of the same preoccupations about the possibility of European man having a spiritual relationship with the landscape rather than an exploitative one. So I wrote to Stowe. His address was given to me by a friend and said, "Did you ever read E.L. Grant Watson when you were young?" And I got this rather annoyed letter back saying, "No, I didn't, or I don't think I did. But why does everyone think that writers are influenced by those who went before?" So I wrote back again and I said, "I'm quite glad to hear that you didn't, but it was a question I had to ask." And he wrote again, and so I'd sort of thought when the book was published I'd send it to him, and this would be a way of continuing the conversation and explaining why I'd written to him in the first place. And then, of course, just before the book came out, he died. And when the friend who'd given me his address came back to Australia, he was lecturing in English at Harvard, I think, we were having a coffee together, and he said, "Why don't you write the biography?" And my initial reaction was, "Oh, I can't do that. You know, he's far too important." And then, of course, once the seed had been sown, I thought about it for a few months, and I thought, "Why not?" And so I did. But I was sorry I was never able to send him that first book and continue the conversation.
So he dies at the age of about
74. Yes. 2010.
Suzanne, you said his books are coded, but autobiographical. Would you give us an example or two of that?
The suggestion is, you said his books were coded, but also autobiographical.
Well, it's hard to give a specific example without notes. But you do find that... I'm thinking in particular of his love poetry. I mean, when you realise it's written to a man rather than to a woman, a lot of things become clear. There are also things that happen in his book, The Girl Green of Elderflower. When you know what happened in New Guinea, you understand why he was writing the things he did about this young man's life in this particular novel. It all... His life and the book speak to each other, and while they're beautiful books and self-contained and make perfect sense as entities, if you know about his life, it entirely enriches the experience of reading them.
Yes, question.
Interesting. He did his 2 years national service, did he? Were there any interesting little snippets from that period? He must have had them.
He was fined once for losing army property. I do remember that. The master of St. George's College had to send a note to his commander at one stage to say he'd missed parade because he was working backstage on a theatrical production. I've managed to track down one of the people that shared a hut with him during the process of the 2 years national service was so many days on weekends if you were a university student, and then a couple of camps where you had to live rough and slog through the bush. I'm told that Mick spent a lot of his time underneath the hut, lying on the cool sand, because of course Western Australia, you know, this clearing in Western Australia that had used to house huts for newly arrived migrants were not the most comfortable places, and he would be smoking a cigarette and reading a poetry magazine, which is not what you're supposed to do if you're an upcoming young soldier.
As you said earlier, this is the early form of conscription in the 1950s, not the form that comes in the 1960s.
So
it would be less than 2 years. It would be a year or less, wouldn't it?
It
might be 8 months or so.
Spread over two years, but it was only a certain number of days. I can't remember how many.
It was 30. Too hard for that, was it? For the lottery.
Yes.
Well, there was people who turned 20 in 1965. Michael, and then we go down the back. Yep.
Are you aware of what prompted the mental breakdown in PNG? And was there anything specific in relation, say, to what he saw as an oppressed race or Papuans who were not given, if you like, the same opportunities? Do you think that transferred itself to his attitude to Aboriginal people? Or what caused that breakdown anyway?
I don't want to go into it too deeply because it was extremely complex and I don't want to deal with it superficially out of context, but because of his family background, because of his mother's attitude, because of his own internalized attitude, it took him a long time to accept that he was gay. And at Sydney University and in the Trobriand Islands and in the years afterwards, it was just beginning to dawn on him that he wasn't going to fall in love with a woman. And he was going to have to somehow deal with this fact that he wasn't. And he came from a family where he suffered, where various members, I think apart from his father, suffered from depression. So it was a combination of that psychological stress, plus he was suffering from malnutrition at the time. He probably contracted malaria, although I don't think he had a bout of malaria. Afterwards, he blamed it on malaria. He said he had something like a fever. But there are lots of fevers you can have in the tropics that aren't malaria. But so it was a combination of physical and mental stress.
Yes, if I could take up Frank's comment about his solitariness, if you like. At least that's the impression we get. And your own quoting of him with respect to E.L. Grant Wood.
Watson,
excuse me. Was he an author whose genius, whose vision, whose talent was essentially native? Did he have no literary heroes, no literary models?
The question is about his literary heroes or his literary models, or was he a kind of native author?
He was highly original. Like Patrick White, he broke new ground. He was criticised by Leonie Kramer, who didn't really understand what he was trying to do. When he was a schoolboy, he admired the Brontes tremendously, and they influenced his first two novels, but then he repudiated them and wouldn't allow them to be republished. Later, he admired Conrad, he admired Judith Wright as a poet. There were a few people that he had enthusiasms for, but I wouldn't say that his work was derivative of any of them.
We're getting close to the end. Yes, Jeff?
My impression was that he wasn't an isolationist, that he had a lot of very good friends that would come to see him in England, and he treated them very hospitably and so on. And also that, as I recall, the stories of him, he regularly went to the pub, something like that, I don't know.
Suggestion is he was quite gregarious, went to the pub.
He was gregarious with people he liked. He didn't have a lot of time for people who were literary groupies or people who wasted his... He couldn't do small talk. He couldn't do social chit-chat. If he could relate to people on a one-to-one level, he was good with them. He'd go to the pub, he'd sit in the corner, do the Times crossword, read a couple of abstruse books that he was using for research, have a couple of schooners of beer, and then go home again. People could go and talk to him if they had something to say, But if they didn't have anything to say, he tended to just sort of grunt and go back to his crossword.
Getting towards the end, maybe this is the final question. I haven't missed anyone. Gale, okay, so I'll ask this and then we'll go to Gale. He was obviously fairly, I mean, as you said, the family is well connected, but if a man in 1959, who was born in 1935, so in his mid-20s, I mean, if he can get a figure like Paul Hasluck, a senior figure in Robert Menzies' cabinet, to give him a recommendation to go to New Guinea, he must have had some kind of considerable social contacts in Perth, because not many young Western Australian men could go up to Paul Hasluck and say they wanted a job somewhere, could they? So what was that influence? That come from the family, his mother, his father, himself?
Well, Western Australia in those days was a small world, and his father, as a lawyer, was familiar with Hasluck, was familiar with Brigadier Cleland, who was the administrator of New Guinea at the time. But what was actually influential was that Alexandra Hasluck and Paul Hasluck, who wrote poetry in his spare time, were already familiar with Mick's work as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old through the Western Australian branch of the, what's it called, the AWA, the Australian... Australian Writers... yes, I've forgotten, but they were already familiar with him through the literary circles. I mean, he knew people, he knew all the writers that were clustered around Perth at that time.
Final question, Gail.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Speak up.
Just saying thanks. We have many examples of expatriate professionals. Australians who are roughly his generation. Did he have a view of the expatriate professional Australian?
He didn't mix with them. But then he didn't mix. He had friendships with various writers, but he tended to interact with people one-on-one. He'd go to the odd Times Literary Supplement Christmas party, I think just out of curiosity. But he didn't hang out in literary circles at all, so he didn't have a view and didn't know the professional Australians in London. He knew the artists. He was good friends with Sidney Nolan.
By professional Australians, I don't mean people with a profession, but those who characterise themselves as Australian or as a spokesperson.
Yes, the ones we sort of lightly call professional expatriates.
Yes.
Yes, yes. No, he didn't have much time for that sort of scene at all.
Well, we're just concluding, just taking up Anne's point, you mentioned that Leonie Cramer didn't quite understand him. So what about the other prominent Australians? What did others think of him, like Clive James, who he would have come across probably, and... maybe Robert Hughes. So, I mean, does he have a kind of a fan club among the Australian intelligentsia, or is he that much a loner that even after nearly 10 years after his death, he still doesn't have this kind of fan club?
Well, I can't think of a list of names at the moment, but a lot of people are under the misapprehension that it was the critical reception by A.D. Hope and Cramer that drove him out of Australia. This wasn't true at all. In fact, his novels were very well received. I quote quite a lot of the reviews. People like Kylie Tennant and the various reviewers on the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age and various other newspapers and the literary journals generally wrote very, very positively about his novels. It was just that a few of the high flyers didn't. And he was very angry when he thought that people... thought he'd been driven away by Cramer and Hope. In fact, he wrote a letter to the TLS saying, "I'd hate to be felled by such a duff shot."
I think that's a nice spot to leave it. So, as I said, there are copies of Mick, A Life of Randolph Stowe, here tonight. I'd just like to say to Suzanne, congratulations on the book. It's
4 years of work. It's a very substantial achievement. And thanks for coming along tonight to talk about your book and how you feel about the author, and give some idea into his political views, among other matters. So once again, congratulations on the book, and many thanks for a great talk at the Institute tonight. Thank you. Thank
you. You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.